On the Empire podcast this week, we talk about Jay Larry with F. Law as Francis Lawrence joins us to talk about his chilly, sexy spy film, Red Sparrow. So apart from the sexy bit, it's a perfect match for the weather this week, which is nice. And we look ahead to this week's Oscars and wonder how many envelope jokes we can expect. All this in the usual movie news, reviews and nonsense on the only movie podcast that would make a sexy Russian spy if only we had the cheekbones for a fur hat. Which is a shame. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Chris Hewitt is off this week because he's writing about Avengers Infinity War, the jammy git. Or so he claims, anyway. Personally, I suspect that he just didn't want to risk going outside. So instead, I'm joined by two colleagues of lethal cunning and also immense amounts of, you know, warm clothing and thermals, because they have braved the day after tomorrow-like weather to be here and struggled into the studio where we are burning folios of old magazines just to stay warm. So first up, we have a man who uses his youthful looks and natural charm to infiltrate the dangerous realms of Empire Online, and apparently who just watched Commando for the first time. It's Ben Travis.
I did. Hello, everyone. I had the best Friday night of all time last week. Ordered a Domino's. Pizza takeaways are available, but got some beers and watched Commando for the first time with my mate, and we basically cackled for 84 solid minutes. It was amazing.
Did you go full Vernon Wells?
You never go full Vernon Wells.
Is that the correct response to Commando? Is it, you know, respectful to cackle the whole way through?
It's respectful. I'm not going to shoot you between the eyes. I'm going to shoot you between the balls.
Amazing.
We did shed a tear in the opening very touching deer sequence. We then, after the film, smushed a little bit of ice cream on each other's faces and wiped it off tenderly with some napkins. It was a beautiful evening.
Wow. I don't know what to say to that. So I will introduce our other guest today. You've already heard him, but this is our very own beast from the East, a man able to chill the blood of lesser men with little more than a Schwarzenegger as Cohen impersonation. It is James Dyer.
Oh, thanks, Helen. I like that one.
Well, you know, I try.
I'm not going to lie. There's a possibility this week's podcast might be especially shambolic. And the reason for that is not because
really?
You're presenting, don't take that the wrong way. It's because I have seen none of the films.
Uh-huh.
I have read no news.
Fantastic.
And I don't even know what the question is.
Brilliant.
So I'm not saying I'm bringing nothing.
But I might.
but I'm bringing little.
I mean, the question was right there in the email.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the email that you probably sent me.
I have many
Chris
notes.
Chris sent you.
Chris sent me an email. Yes. Oh, it came from Chris, of course I didn't.
Ben literally has notes. He has like two pages of notes that I can see.
Okay.
I've got a script on a computer.
Oh, this is going to be good. This is going to be good. So don't tell me what it is, and when we get to it, I'll just make it up as I go along.
Well, I mean, that is a nice segue, actually, because it is time for a question. So here we go. From Jake Terrell. I'm guessing this came via either Facebook or, you know, email, because I haven't got a handle for him. But it says, having recently visited the Arnold Schwarzenegger Museum, wow, there's a theme here already.
It's a real army vibe.
Having recently visited the Arnold Schwarzenegger Museum in his childhood home just outside Graz, which he says is well worth a visit, they have the bike from T2 and there's even a phone box full of weights in the car park to do your workout in. Pretty unusual. He was wondering, what's your favourite movie themed museum or shrine?
Ooh.
Ooh.
I've got my notes.
Go on, I will concede to the right honourable gentleman with his notes.
So half of my list is stuff that I've been to, and half of them are things that I would love to go to if I get the chance.
Cool.
So I'll start with the ones I've been to. First up, the Harry Potter studio tour.
Yes.
In Watford.
Yes.
As a massive Harry Potter fan, as a child of the Harry Potter generation, I went to the Harry Potter studio tour three times in a year. And it's amazing. There is so much good stuff there.
Do they do the butterbeer there?
They do.
They do, and it is absolutely disgusting.
Do they do both versions of the butterbeer?
They do.
What?
They do butterbeer, and they do butterbeer ice cream. The ice cream is worth having, because it's basically like butterscotch.
Yeah.
And the butterbeer itself is...
It's so
made
sweet.
Me feel physically sick.
Yeah.
It's like fizzy soda, like coloured fizzy soda with very little taste.
It's amazing.
And then a thick sort of layer of creamy stuff on top, and that is just such a bad combination.
I have to say, I was also there three times in a year, but that was in fairness before it opened. Yeah, I don't know if that makes me more special or something.
You're a death eater, aren't you?
What was really unusual is that they actually, the first time I went, they were all like, we're not going to have butter beer. This is not the Harry Potter experience that you get, you know, if you go to Universal. It's not going to be a thing. And then rather sheepishly, I got a phone call a few weeks later going, yeah, there is going to be butterbeer, and we know you put it in print that there wasn't, so we were wondering if you'd like to come back and have some butterbeer.
How did you find it?
Thanks, guys. Yeah, it's too much. It's gross, fabulous, but it's far too much.
I had about 4 cups of it back to back. Because I went to, I've not been to that one. I've been to, obviously, Hogwarts/Hogsmeade at Universal Studios.
Universal, yeah.
And they do the, you know, chilled soft drink butterbeer, but they also do the slushy, like the really like the slushy butterbeer. And I felt it was my duty to try them both. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then it was hot, so I tried them both again.
As a huge fan of Tango Ice Blasts, I would absolutely love to try.
Yeah, that seems sensible.
Yeah, they were pretty cool. It was very hot.
But yeah, the studio tour is incredible.
It's phenomenal.
They have so much stuff, and they've recreated half of the sets. If you're a big Harry Potter fan and you've never been, it's so worth going. And they do kind of timely exhibitions and add-ons, and you can get your photo taken in front of the Hogwarts Express. And
on a broomstick.
On a broomstick. You can walk through the carriages of the train. Also, you are going to want to set aside at least an hour for the gift shop.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
They have, like, plushes of absolutely everything.
Now, have they... the thing that I wanted was those hog-headed jugs from the tables, and last time I went, they didn't have them yet in the gift shop, and I really want them to be there one day, because those are amazing.
Is it the Hogshead? What's it called?
Thing?
It is
the pub in Hogsmeade.
Yeah. So that's in the Hogsmeade Recreation at Universal, along with all the little boutique shops and everything, which is kind of mental. It's I really like it there. It's
pretty good. They also have extremely enthusiastic volunteers who are wonderful. Many of them were extras in the film or were when it opened. And I went with my sister at one point, who's like yourself, Ben, a very big Potter fan. And one of the very enthusiastic, very helpful volunteers started explaining which dragon we were looking at a model of. And we walked off, and my sister went to me, as if I wouldn't be able to recognise a Norwegian Ridgeback.
That's hilarious. The funny thing is, with the rides, they did 2 phases of them. And the first phase, obviously, all the cars got involved. And they recorded sections, and there's bits of video of them doing it. And then in the second phase, Emma Watson wouldn't do it. So you go into the ride, and you've got Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and then shit Hermione, who sounds absolutely nothing like her.
And they looks just got some random.
Nothing, yeah, just some random. Oh, you're female, brilliant. You know, off you go. And and you get, what are they? Apparated. You get apparated by shit Hermione.
What else?
So the other one I had was something that was in London for a while, but it's a touring exhibition that I think now has left London, possibly not the UK. The Star Wars Identities exhibition, which was at the O2 for quite a while last year. I went to this for something for my last job to do some filming there, and I'm a big Star Wars fan. I was really looking forward to it, and the sort of gimmick of it was that you go and you create your own Star Wars character as you go around, and it digs into the mythology, and you kind of make various choices as to who you would be in the Star Wars universe. That massively buried the lead, because the real thing was that there were like 200 or 300 like real kind of props, and the actual Millennium Falcon that they used to film all the model work in Empire Strikes Back, Han Solo's actual trousers,
the actual Millennium Falcon. That I've been in on the set of Empire Strikes Back.
Oh no, like the little model, all the like model work that they did.
You probably never heard James mention that before, but he was on set.
Oh, I've never heard that before. There's the actual Han Solo in carbonite, and it was incredible. And I found myself looking at all the posters on the tube saying, don't push the, like, you make a Star Wars character. Push, these are actual, like, genuine kind of Star Wars props and things from over the years. That was amazing. If you ever see that touring, I think it's at least touring Europe, maybe still going around the UK.
Get on.
Definitely go if you're a Star Wars
fan. I have the same problem that many of my favourite sort of movie experiences have been touring things. So I think we went, James, back in the day to 2 different exhibitions, which were the Pixar exhibition at the Science Museum. Were you at that one?
Yes, this rings a bell.
That was phenomenal. It was Pixar concept art and everything else. They had this incredible, I don't know what the word for it is, but a thing that rotates, and through the use of flashing images, it becomes animated. But it was
like
a model.
Like a sort of rotoscope.
It wasn't like a... I don't know if that's what you call it, but anyway, it was incredible and I loved it. And that was amazing. And also at the Science Museum, they had the Lord of the Rings exhibition, which I had almost a similar reaction to the actual props of that one, because it was things like they had printed the lining of Denethor's tunic with his house coat of arms and that kind of thing. Like the level of obsessive, compulsive detail in that was mind-blowing, and absolutely, they're beautiful, beautiful things. And I still regret that I did not feel able at that point to spend £140 on a Hobbit cloak because they were things of beauty. Just the wool involved in those cloaks, they're gorgeous, gorgeous things. And they were phenomenal.
It's funny you mentioned that. I went to the Lord of the Rings exhibition when it was at Te Papa in New Zealand, where they had absolutely everything. It's the entire museum pretty much was taken over. And this is, I think, the biggest museum in New Zealand, with just everything, you know, wall to wall. There were elven swords everywhere. And I remember they had this one chamber where the One Ring was kind of sitting and had Sauron over it. And you went in and it was just the elven script projected on all the walls. It's really dark, so it's just red projections. And you just heard like the sort of like Gandalf's voice speaking the black tongue of Mordor from the ring. It was so cool. That was very cool. I think that's one of the only like proper museum type things I've been to. I mean, I've been to the Lucasfilm archives at Skywalker Ranch. Obviously, you can't really buy tickets for that. But that's amazing because they have all of the props from all of the films. And they've got the amazing mats they used in, obviously, the Star Wars films, also all the other Lucasfilm stuff. There's the mat of the, you know, where the Ark ends up at the end of Raiders of the Lost Star. In fact, the Ark is actually in the archive. Oh, the Ark is there, as is the Grail and the Grail Diary. And numerous versions of the Golden Idol. So they've got the one from the final film. And they've got the early idol, which actually had, there was a shot in it where it had kind of human eyes, where the eyes followed him, which they didn't use, but that version's in there as well.
Wow.
So I've hung around with that. And then the only other thing which comes close is when we shot James Cameron for the thing we did in the magazine last year, the big Empire interview, we shot him on in his own little personal museum space where he's got all of the props in his film. So you've got the Na'vi heads, lots of Na'vi artifacts. The power loader from Aliens is in there. The alien queen from Aliens is in there. The Titanic, the kind of whatever it is to scale-ish, is about 50 feet long. Sort of is the model of the Titanic. And then next to it is the model of the sunken Titanic. And he's even, of all the random things he's got in there, so he's got the like the helm of the ship is in there, like the wheel, whatnot.
I went to the Stanley Kubrick exhibition at, I think it was at LACMA in LA.
Oh, did you know?
A few years ago, and that was phenomenal and made me love Stanley Kubrick a lot more than I was otherwise inclined to. And also is a fantastic opportunity to learn something that will enable you to win arguments with Spielberg skeptics by showing you that the ending of AI was Kubrick's. Stop adding me about this. Anyway, so that was a really good one as well. But in terms of, you know, permanent museums, I mean, the Cine Museum in London, is that still open?
It is.
I should check this. It is, good. Because it's fantastic. And it has Ray Harryhausen models, which blew my mind a bit. And another Alien Queen, which is phenomenal looking. And it is that's a really good afternoon, actually, I have to say. It's really lovely.
Extremely high up my list of would love to go to is the Ghibli Museum. If anyone fancies giving me a couple of grand to go out to Tokyo and then head out to the Ghibli Museum, I'd love to do that. All the pictures and stuff, you can have a look online, but they've got huge kind of gardens and giant scale models of the robots from Laputa. And there is like an exclusive Ghibli short that you can only see in the museum. I think probably still in Japanese, but you can at least look at all the lovely diagrams.
Nick and Chris have been there. But yeah, they said it was great. Of course it is in Japan, though I'm sure there's a cat bus.
You can ride the cat bus.
Amazing. I want to go.
The other one that was up my list and was a touring exhibition is the Guillermo del Toro exhibition that's been on fairly recently. Yeah. So my sister went. She lives in Toronto and she got to go while it was there, and I was looking at all of her photos of it just with intense jealousy. So it's got, I think, stuff from his personal monster collection and then loads of stuff from his films as well. So there's like a big model of the Pale Man from Pan's Labyrinth. They seem to have loads of beautiful costumes from Crimson Peak, which, whatever you think of that film, the production design on it is absolutely gorgeous. So that would be high up my list. I think it's still been moving around some other US cities. I don't know if we'll ever get a chance to see it here, but if it does, I will be first in line for tickets.
I also get just geeked out just going to locations where big stuff has happened. I went to Haddon Hall in Yorkshire last year for the first time. And that is one of the places that they filmed The Princess Bride. It's a lot of Humperdinck's castle is Haddon Hall. And I had a moment. I really did. I had a moment. So that was pretty cool. And even just like the first time I went to New York and went up the Empire State Building or went to the New York Public Library, it's kind of a trip. Like just anywhere where I think one of your beloved films has happened is pretty cool. Pretty exciting. Yeah. It's kind of nice living in London that way sometimes, you know. You sometimes wander around and go, seen this on screen.
Yeah. I'm from Nottingham as well, and the Dark Knight Rises shot all of the Wayne Manor stuff in Woolerton Hall in Nottingham, which I used to go to loads as a kid. Like, we used to go, and they've got like big parks and grounds and stuff, and they do film screenings there now. I think they showed The Dark Knight Rises at Woolerton Hall, but that was such a surreal experience of thinking that like Nolan and Christian Bale and everyone was like 10 minutes down the road from my house, from where I grew up, filming that.
If you would like your question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can get us on Twitter, where we are at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or we might not see it. On Facebook, we are also Empire Magazine, which shows a little bit of a lack of originality there. And if you want to email us, we are podcast@empireonline.com. So please do get in touch. Right, time now for some lovely movie news, which will hopefully contain some snippets to warm the frozen cockles of our hearts. What shall we start with? Shall we start with news of Kristen Wiig?
Sure. What news of Kristen Wiig,
Helen?
What
news? The news is that she is in talks to play the villain in Wonder Woman 2, whatever we're calling it. So she would be playing Cheetah, who's a long-standing Wonder Woman villain. And this would be the Barbara Ann Minerva incarceration of Cheetah, apparently, who's an heiress who went through an ancient ritual involving eating human blood mixed with special berries, a bit like Black Panther, but a bit more...
Bit of seasoning there.
Bit of seasoning, a bit of cannibalism there on the edge. Mm-hmm. And then she gets superhuman feline powers.
That's lucky.
But she has to pay a price for them, of course.
Are they expensive?
I think, like, morally.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
James doesn't understand that.
So, yeah, it's an unusual maybe choice for that, I would have said.
Is she a lot like Chitara from Thundercats?
Is anyone like Chitara from Thundercats? There is only one Chitara, surely.
That's fair.
But yeah, there's no deal in place yet. This is talks, apparently. But apparently Patty Jenkins sought her out and talked to her about this role and talked it up. And she's been Jenkins obviously been developing the film with her co-writers at the moment. So we don't have any, you know, details yet. The rumour is that the movie's set during the Cold War, so it would still be a period piece vis-a-vis the Justice League movies. But we don't know much more than that. But I don't know. I think this is... I mean, I think Kristen Wiig could make a great villain, but she has usually played more comedic villains.
Yeah, has she done some more serious roles? I'm having a bit of a Kristen Wiig mind blank.
I mean, she has. I mean, things like maybe Skeleton Twins and stuff like that was a lot more serious. Oh, yeah. I mean, she's certainly a hell of an actress. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a disconnect, I would have thought, in terms of between her and the comic book.
I think as well, for people who have who don't really see Kristen Wiig fitting into that world. I think somebody pointed out on our Twitter that, like, when Heath Ledger was first announced The Dark Knight, like, I remember thinking, I don't get it.
It's that dude from A Knight's Tale.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
I mean, pre-internet, when they announced Michael Keaton for Batman, you know, went absolutely bananas. So, absolutely. I mean, you know, not to do anyone down. I love her. I think she's great. But it is a very big step away from how the character looks and acts, I would say, in the comics. Mm-hmm. So, which could be a good thing, which could mean that they're doing something really unusual and really different with her, which is always good to be surprising. But yeah, this is, I think it's a bit of a surprise, but not necessarily a bad one. So fingers crossed for that. So Wonder Woman 2 is due in, I think, 2019. Got a bit of time on it. What other news?
So the one that's towards the top of my list is the trailer for Ralph Breaks the Internet, Wreck-It Ralph 2. Going the Lost World Jurassic Park way round of doing the sequel name, and then the franchise we know and love. But yeah, the first trailer arrived 2 days ago, as of you guys listening to this now, and it looks kind of like the Emoji Movie done right. Helen, you reviewed the Emoji Movie, right? It was done.
I did.
It was done wrong.
It was so wrong.
Yeah, it looks like an intriguingly similar premise. So, as the title suggests, in this one, Ralph and Vanellope von Schweetz get uploaded to the internet, and quite a lot of the trailer plays on them suddenly finding themselves in the World Wide Web and encountering various sort of brands and stuff that we already know and that we use every day, but baked within that, there is some really like impressively weird jokes. So there's a great bit of them looking at weird eBay auctions, of them staring into the eyes of a sad kitten painting. And there's a final joke with an iPad game where Ralph starts force-feeding this bunny insane amounts of pancakes until it explodes and it's got syrup oozing from its mouth, and it just looks really strange and weird. So I enjoyed the trailer quite a lot. I'm looking forward to what they do with this.
I'm not going to lie to you, Ben. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched the trailer.
Okay.
But I have...
Hashtag top film
journalism. I'm nothing if not professional. I have, however, seen a couple of very extended sequences from this film. And it looks really, really good. The stuff I've seen is there's loads and loads of funny stuff on, you know, on advertising pop-up spam and viruses. So yes. There's lots of internet gags in there. And there's a bit where they go to what is essentially Disney.com. And there's Star Wars stuff. There's a Stan Lee cameo. Yes.
I think it's going to have that Ready Player One thing, right? Like, it's going to be the year
it is
of massive
meta. Spot it. But there's a bit where Vanellope ends up sort of like hanging out, doing like a slumber party with all the Disney princesses. All voiced by the actual Disney princesses.
Really?
And I mean every single one, including Merida as well.
Yeah.
And there's some really, really good gags in there. Like genuinely very well written, very observant, incredibly wry, and absolutely lost on anyone under the age of about 18. But really, really good stuff in there. So yeah, I'm really excited about this. I am not at all a fan of Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh, I
think it was a horrendous missed opportunity because you know, I know my computer games, and I went in there expecting like an homage to computer games, and what we got was maybe 5 minutes of that at the beginning and featuring the games they could get the licenses to include. So, you know, Street Fighter, a little bit of Sonic, you know, and then like a crappy StarCraft ripoff. No, I was not happy with any of that shit. And then it became a game about sweets and go-karts. It's like, oh yes, this is a riff on Mario Kart, but actually you don't have any of the characters or any of the properties. So this has nothing to do with video games at all.
James.
Sorry. I thought that was a missed opportunity. However, this one seems to be correcting all of that. They seem to have worked out exactly what it is they want to do. They've made sure that they can legally do. I mean, it helps that Disney own the universe, so by using Disney properties, they're absolutely golden. So they've got the Marvel, they've got Star Wars, got everything. Yeah, I think this could be really good. Genuinely, I'm very looking forward to this.
I'm also very excited to see what Kanye West makes of Wreck-It Ralph 2, because I'm a massive Kanye fan of his music and his long, rambly interviews. And one of my favourite things is that he often brings up a scene from Wreck-It Ralph when he's talking about how he doesn't feel welcomed in the fashion industry. So he always brings up the bit where Vanellope von Schweetz has her car wrecked by the mean racers
girls
from the Sugar Rush game. And he's given interviews before where he's kind of talking about how that's what he relates to, and shouting, "I am the glitch. People see me as the glitch."
Oh, bless.
So I'm really intrigued to see what he gets out of this and if it influences anything he's got coming up.
I mean, fingers crossed for a Ralph Breaks the Internet tie-in fashion line, right?
I mean, I would buy it.
That's one. So that's
one
good
sold.
News. That is one sold. At the other end of the sort of maturity spectrum, in terms of who can watch a film, there is news of Quentin Tarantino's latest. So it now has an official title.
Quentin Breaks the Internet.
I mean, possibly, but it's they're going with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So we now know that Leonardo DiCaprio will be playing a former Western TV star called Rick Dalton, which is a great Western TV star name.
Yeah, it's a very TV star name.
That is solid. And Pitt plays his stuntman.
Yeah.
Cliff
so Brad
Booth.
Pitt's back. Back teaming it with Tarantino for the first time since Inglourious Bastards, would it be?
I believe so, yeah.
Which we were discussing in The Office is terrifyingly 10 years old this year.
Oh,
how
what?
Has that happened?
Yeah.
Yep.
No, so, what? No.
I think so. Or maybe it was 2009. Maybe
by the time
year
this
off.
Comes
hang
out.
Hang on. I'm interrupting this to bring you a very special broadcast.
Oh, no.
Hello?
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 What you doing?
Nothing, really. We're recording a podcast, Chris.
What's a podcast?
How is your Infinity War feature going?
Infinity by name, infinity by nature.
Don't tell anyone. It's not, but it's going very well.
Excellent.
It's going great. And as soon as I start, it's going to be brilliant.
We are in the process of discussing news. We're talking about the new Tarantino.
Oh, I have no opinions on that. All I can see at the moment is Tony Stark, so it's all good. But I just wanted to call you three to tell you that I miss you and I love you. And I cannot wait to be with you again.
Thanks,
Chris. We feel the same way.
Do we?
Okay, thanks for very much, guys. And never call me again.
Bye, Chris.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was a thing.
That was Chris. Never one to knowingly let a podcast go by without being in it.
He sounds like a broken man. If
he
I'm
does.
Honest. I mean, I can't see why. It's not like he has 40 A-list stars to transcribe.
Is that the ultimate procrastination? Phoning in a podcast that you're not
edit
on?
Into a feature and generally make something out of. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. Anyway, we were talking about Tarantino.
Yes, we were.
So we know this film is set in the 1960s. We're now told that the Manson murders are a backdrop rather than a focus. Mm-hmm. But we're also told that Dalton, that's DiCaprio's character, is neighbours with Sharon Tate, who was, of course, a victim of the Mansons. And that is the role that Margot Robbie is said to be circling. So we shall see.
So it could be a grand reunion for Tarantino and Brad Pitt, and also Leo and Margot Robbie reteaming for the first time since Wolf of Wall Street.
Good point.
That is one heck of a cast.
That is a solid cast, and I am much more comfortable with having the Manson murders as a backdrop rather than a focus because, ew, gross. And also the whole idea of, you know, releasing it on the anniversary of the killing spree is still quite gross, so... Yeah. Hey-ho. The idea of DiCaprio and Pitt together I think is really intriguing, and that should be quite cool.
Definitely. I mean, it's always intriguing to see what Tarantino's cooking up next. So whatever we find out about it in the run-up, I think we'll all be there on opening night.
Absolutely. Now, Tarantino, obviously known for good film music, but there is one film that's known for better film music than any Tarantino film, and that is, of course, 9 to 5. Which has, hands down, the greatest theme tune in the history of Hollywood. Don't even at me. I'm not interested in your opinions. Dolly Parton is a goddess. Do you know Dolly Parton has given away 100 million books to underprivileged kids in the US? 100 million books.
I did not know that.
This woman...
No one can read 100 million books, Helen. That's ridiculous.
You haven't seen my library, James. She has given away 100 million books around the US over the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years or something. She has her own freaking theme park. The woman is amazing. And of course, this film, the original film, starred Dolly with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. What an incredible lineup. It's still a comedy that stands up. And actually, it's a comedy that is extremely timely right now because it is all about an awful sexist boss and three young women trying to deal with him in the workplace who all have their own different problems with him. So it's a phenomenal film. It's been made into a stage show in the meantime. I think Alison Janney was in it, James, so you know it's good.
I'm automatically going to see this now.
So what is this, a new version?
Would be a new version. They're trying to get the original three back for appearances. Now, I have to say, Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin have been working together on the fantastic TV show Grace and Frankie, which stars... also, Martin Sheen, James.
And also Lily Tomlin, who was also in the West Wing.
Who was also in the West Wing, so you know this is good stuff. So they've been working together, and they've been trying, apparently, to get Dolly Parton to appear in that, and so far the schedules obviously haven't lined up. But they are trying to get all three of them back in some circumstance for this film, whether they'd play the original characters or just older ladies, perhaps mothers, grandmothers, whatever, don't know. But apparently the original co-writer and creator, Patricia Resnick, is ready to return, and she's talking to Rashida Jones, which is exciting, about working together on an updated screenplay that would see three young women dealing with sexism in the workplace. So it seems incredibly timely, given Me Too and Time's Up and all the rest. And it was a massive hit back in the day. I'm not sure if anyone deserves the chance to re-record or touch or remix or do anything with that theme tune, but I'm open to suggestions if there's someone out there who's brilliant. But yeah, that is a thing that is at least in development. So it's only said to be in development. It's a very early stage. You obviously need three modern equivalents of Lily, Jane and Dolly. No pressure, but I'm excited.
Having never seen the original, is this another one that I should add to my Friday night film list?
I genuinely think you should. It's weird. Like, it's a lot weirder than I thought it was going to be just hearing about it. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty cool.
What pizza and alcoholic beverage would we... Oh, are you guys both teetotalers?
No.
I very rarely.
What food and drink combination should I pair?
Well, the only alcohol I like is Sambuca, so I'm not sure that's going to help you very much.
That's really intense.
No, but it tastes like sweets, Ben.
I mean, I'm not sure if I'm being sort of, you know, just stereotypical here, but probably a wine is the one to have with the film, given
I'd give you a wine.
The subject. Well, you always do, James.
Just saying.
In terms of food, I think a good American burger would be fine, actually. I mean, given that, you know, Dolly Parton, she doesn't seem like a salad eater, even if she is. She seems like a burger eater.
Well, that's my next Friday lined up.
There you go.
No. Right. So you've seen Commando. Have you seen Raw Deal?
I've not seen it.
Have you seen Predator?
I've seen
Predator. Okay, because that was a trick question because you were getting fired if you hadn't seen that one. Have you seen The Running Man?
Oh, come on. The Running Man is not more essential than 9 to 5.
Don't be ridiculous. How dare you?
Come on. I can say that because I just watched Predator again the other day.
Yeah,
I've had my shot.
Don't worry, Ben. We will educate you. Once you've seen Schwarzenegger's entire back catalogue, then you can watch 9 to 5.
Okay.
Wow, really? All of them?
Yeah, except everything since he came back from politics you can probably skip. Okay. But you know, everything up to Terminator 3 you have to watch.
I've seen all the Terminators. Well, not Salvation, but I think
Salvation's not that bad. That gets a really hard time.
Silver Surfer movie. What?
The movie no one's been crying out for. Yeah, a standalone Silver Surfer movie. I know this because I've Googled it and I have it on my screen now. And there's a Silver Surfer standalone movie in the works, it says.
Keep scrolling. There
yes.
we go.
And it turned... Oh, yeah, well, obviously the last time we saw him was in Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer, mm-hmm. which we can all agree is a spectacularly good film. He is back. Brian K. Vaughan is writing a new take. They'll bring the character back, possibly with Galactus, not with Galactus. We don't know. Let's hope, because Galactus is, you know, a giant planet-eating guy, and that's always funny.
And not a giant cloud.
No,
let's just get that
he's
straight.
Not a cloud. He has a big hat. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, why not? Do it.
Like, where
Fine.
Is this going to sit in with the sort of Disney and Fox deal and the
Nobody
the
knows,
Marvel
so I think...
And,
I mean, let's be honest. Is this actually going to get made? Mm. Because I feel a lot like a lot of the, you know, the X-Men universe stuff. Like, if I had to guess, I would say, depending on how well Deadpool 2 does, that will, like, if that makes a shit ton of money, then that will probably continue in some form or fashion. But I feel a lot like the X-Men stuff will all kind of wind down and they will reboot all of that within the MCU and then all this stuff will just get brushed under.
I mean, it's kind of a good time to do that right now that Logan has wrapped up with Wolverine.
You're quite right, but I think there's a bit of time. Like, this deal's not going to go through that quickly, so I think we have some breathing room and obviously they want to churn this stuff out in the meantime, which I can kind of understand. But obviously New Mutants has now been pushed back by a year.
Did you hear that? Adding a whole new character
I
to
was
that.
Just going to say, this is...
Who are they adding?
They are adding... I don't believe that they've said. It's currently undisclosed.
If it's Stan Lee, I'm going to burn the building down.
No, I think this is like a character who is a part of the film, like a big part of the story. And they have done these reshoots recently and they have knocked back the release date, I believe, a little bit further to allow them to add... another. Now, that actually does support the chance of at least one of these other movies happening.
Yeah.
So, because in the works, we have this in theoretical Silver Surfer by Brian K. Vaughan. Mm-hmm. We have the Kitty Pryde film with Tim Miller and Brian Michael Bendis. Mm-hmm. We have Drew Goddard's X-Force, as well as obviously Deadpool 2 and a Doctor Doom film from Noah Hawley, who created Legion. So, if I was guessing, and I am absolutely only guessing... The most obvious one you would think in New Mutants would be Kitty Pryde, right?
It makes the most sense.
Yeah.
And also she fits in with that cast and that world.
Exactly.
But it's hard to be, you know, scared of a horror thing when you're intangible.
Yeah, you can run away any room.
Literally run through it, run away, run through a wall, fall through the floor. Basically can't be hurt.
Unless she turns up, you know, at some other time or comes in early and then leaves, or there's got to be something.
Or maybe her powers are glitching.
Or maybe
she could get everyone else out, right? She could phase everyone else out of the
unless
situation.
Like it depends what powers the villain has, I guess. But yeah, this is so anyway, we don't know enough to know much at this point. But there is news.
I mean, there's
from,
a lot in the works. On,
there's
on
a lot
the,
in the works.
On the Fox Marvel side of things.
And maybe there's something to be said for throwing a lot of balls up in the air and seeing what lands where.
On whose head?
On whose head be it. Yes.
Yeah.
Speaking of comics, as we tend to be somehow, We start off with talking about Kristen Wiig playing a character whose surname was Minerva. Well, that brings me neatly to the news that Gemma Chan may be joining Captain Marvel, and she's apparently cast as a character called Min-Irva. That's Min with two N's.
The intern was in charge of that character got created.
Yeah, it's not. It's maybe not their absolute best work. In fairness, of course, we're talking about two different comic universes here, DC and Marvel, two very different characters, Min-Irva with hyphenation. And I do love a person who has punctuation in their name because I identify strongly with them. She is a Kree geneticist and spy, and she has a very complicated comic book history. So she could be any kind of goody, baddie, neutrally, virtually anything, actually. So we just don't know what they're going to do with her.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know very much about the character, but I really like Gemma Chan. She's been amazing. I don't know if you guys have watched Humans on Channel 4.
Fantastic.
Which I think season 3 is coming up. But yeah, she's great in that show. And on the one hand, she has to be entirely robotic, and then on the other hand, has to be entirely human, and she works that spectrum like really spectacularly. So it's really great to see her getting like a being propelled really to the next level.
That's probably it for movie news. I think it's probably all the time we have.
Except M. Night Shyamalan is doing a TV show for Apple that we don't know anything about. We don't know what it's about. We don't know what it's called. But it comes coinciding with news that his other TV show that he kind of produced, Wayward Pines, has, shock horror dismay, been cancelled. Which is a shame, actually, because I really enjoyed season one. Did you see about Wayward Pines?
I did not.
It's Matt Dillon. I really enjoyed season one. And then season two, I will confess, was not good.
I mean, season one covered the entire book trilogy, right?
It did,
Which was a great idea, because you just think, let's not faff around, let's just condense it all. Like, it made for a really exciting first season. Yeah. And then they decided to continue it past the books and didn't really
Time jump, and Dillon wasn't in it anymore, and it was just like, I mean, yeah, the second season was
awful. You could say it went wayward.
You could indeed say that. And I am pining for a third season that I will never see. But let's move on.
Okay, listen, I think that really is enough now for movie news. So it is time for a guest. And this week we have a man who definitely has a favourite leading lady, but who swears it's not because they're secretly related and that they just happen to share a surname. Francis Lawrence, for it is he, made his mark with a criminally underrated Constantine. Yes, I said it. And then went on to make I Am Legend before making three Hunger Games films with a certain Jennifer Lawrence. He reunites with his Katniss Everdeen in this week's Red Sparrow, a hard-edged spy story where Lawrence plays a woman trained to use sex as a weapon to secure information from the other side in a modern-day Cold War.
We've all done it.
Okay. Who did we send along to speak to him?
Me.
It was Ben.
It was me.
Here we go. So here you are, Francis and Ben.
Great. So I'm thrilled to be joined here on the Empire podcast by the director of Red Sparrow, Francis Lawrence. How
Hello.
Are you doing?
Good. I'm doing well, thanks.
Fantastic. So to start things off, when did you first come across the script for Red Sparrow? Had you read the novel first, or did you come across the script at some point?
No, I read the novel first. Fox sent me the novel. I think it was in 2015. We were finishing Mockingjay Part 2. I was in post on that film. And yeah, Fox sent it to me, and I read it and fell in love with it and sort of got started on it right away. And so by the time that we were finished with press and release of Mockingjay 2, this was basically ready to go.
What was it that stood out about the novel for you?
I think I fell in love with the character of Dominica. I just thought that she was very unique, and I thought that her character journey was really unique. And I also just thought it was a very new way of getting into a spy film. I've always been a fan of the spy genre, but anything that's very genre-specific tends to fall into certain kinds of tropes, and I found this story, this narrative, very unique.
You mentioned you just come off the back of working with Jennifer Lawrence for three films in the Hunger Games series.
Yes.
When you read the book and when you were working on the script, did you always think of Jennifer Lawrence for that lead role? Did she immediately spring to mind, or did it come through some other process?
No, I thought about her immediately. Even while reading the book, I thought I was thinking about Jennifer for it, and I knew she could do a great job. We obviously enjoy working together. And oddly, I thought she could look Russian, which I thought was, you know, part of what would work. So very early on, I actually pitched her the story in a very sort of cursory way, just to say, hey, hypothetically, would you be interested in doing a movie like this and a character like this? And she said yes. And so both the studio and I thought of Jen all the way through the development. But honestly, I was a little nervous she wasn't going to want to do it. because she wasn't really aware of the content of the movie at the time when I pitched it, and I knew she had not really been interested in doing anything with nudity or overt sexuality, you know, when she was younger, and I didn't know if her mind had changed or not. So, but I mean, she wanted to do it when she read the script.
What was it like reuniting with her? What does she bring to the role for you, and what does she bring to a film set?
Well, I mean, she's a fantastic actress. I mean, she could do anything she wants. And I think one of the things that really excited me about doing this with her was we had just spent about 5 years together doing three movies and with her playing the same character. We loved those movies, the themes, the story, the characters, all that. But after 5 years, you're like, okay, let's try something new. So to be able to go and create a completely different world with a new character where she looks different, she sounds different, she moves differently, she pushes herself into new territory, that was really exciting to me. So that was one huge thing. I mean, the other great thing about Jen is she's just really fun to work with. I'm a big believer that, you know, the bulk of our lives, whether you're an actor, a director, a crew member, right, is spent making the movies, not watching them be released into the world. And so, honestly, the fun part has to be making the movie. Because if a movie works or it doesn't work in the end, the bulk of your time was making it. And she's fun to work with. She's really good at what she does, so that's always exciting. But she can turn the character on and off when she needs to, and she's fun to be around. She's funny. She's smart. So just a great partner.
And she's just one part of an amazing cast that you've got together for this. You've got even people like Charlotte Rampling and Jeremy Irons in kind of supporting roles. What was it like being able to pull together actors of that caliber for Red Sparrow?
Well, one of the first things that happens is, you know, you have this kind of wish list of people. And luckily, I got everybody on my wish list. You know, there's a certain moment where these people are signing on where you're kind of validated because you've been working on a script. And so you hope people aren't sort of turning it down all the time. And so you get, you know, there's a feeling of validation, but also an excitement to get to work with some of the people that you've wanted to work with for a really long time. I mean, of course, you know, Jeremy Irons is one of the greatest actors of all time. I mean, Charlotte Rampling is unbelievable. Matthias, you know, I've loved him since I saw him in Bullhead and Rust and Bone. I mean, he's fantastic. And Joel, I mean, I remember seeing him, I think, for the first time in Animal Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And my friend Scott Cooper directed him in Black Mass and just said what a great guy he was. And I honestly think that he's one of the best working actors today. I mean, of that age range, I think he's probably the best.
You alluded before to the fact that this is a very different sort of role for Jennifer Lawrence. And one of the things you mentioned was the accent. There's always, I think, when you've got a film set in or around Russia, how far you go with the accent. How did you make the decision that you did to have everyone speaking, obviously, English, but with that Russian inflection? And how far did you want to push that?
Well, there's a few ways of going about this kind of language issue. One is you do it all in Russian and you subtitle it, which I just was not going to do, because you're basically then making a foreign language film. And I wasn't interested in that. The other version is the sort of Hunt for Red October version, where people start speaking in Russian and then you do some sort of weird transition effect. And then everybody's in their own dialect, whether it's American or Scottish or, you know, whatever. And I didn't want to do that. They did it very well, but I didn't want to copy that. And so I went the route of the hint of accent. I think a Russian accent is easy to get really heavy with. It's very, a lot of people sort of overdo it. And we did a ton of research, honestly. What I did was, first I went to my casting director and said, hey, listen, I need you to go out and find young women who are Russian but have been living in America for a very long time, so they have a very light accent. And so she sent me, I don't know, five or six young women. I picked one with Jen. We used her as a reference. We then brought in dialect coaches. He brought in more women with more recordings. And then we started to use that as a reference. Then we also brought in some men so that the men could listen to some men. But it was all based on that. But it was always, the idea was to go very, very, very light. So it was sort of a hint. It was kind of just part of the fabric of the world.
One of the things I loved was the opening sequence, which focuses pretty heavily on the ballet side of Dominica's character. What was it like shooting the ballet sequence? And did you look at other kind of classic ballet-inflected films to kind of take reference for that?
I didn't really look at a lot of ballet, other ballet films. I did a lot of research on the ballet. I mean, I didn't know that much about the ballet before starting this movie. That's part of the fun for me, is getting to know things that I wasn't, you know, really, you know, that knowledgeable about. And so I watched a lot of documentaries. And one of those documentaries was how I found my choreographer, Justin Peck, with the New York City Ballet. So we got in contact with him. He agreed to do it. So we started basically having him choreograph a sort of an interpretation of the Firebird. Using elements of the Firebird music. Then we got Jen hooked up with a trainer, and she trained for 3 or 4 months, working maybe 4 hours a day or something like that, doing different exercises to learn how to open up her joints, learn the choreography, learn how to control her arms, her fingers, how to stand right, get the right posture, all of this. And she learned the choreography. And our choreographer also had, he's off, you know, he choreographs for New York City Ballet, so he knows a lot of ballerinas. And he picked Isabella Boylston, who's with the ABT, who's a fantastic dancer. She's a principal there, and she was Jen's double. And so shooting this sequence, what we did was, we shot in the Budapest Opera House, and we had 800 extras out in the audience, and we would bring Isabella out, and she would do whatever piece we were going to get a shot for. And the choreography was sort of split up into kind of 4 chunks. She would do it, and then we'd bring Jen out, and she would do it. And so we could marry the two together. So you have Jen's kind of emotion and face and basically neck up and a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And then the dancing for, you know, legs and all that kind of stuff typically would be Isabella. So it's now a combo, but it was probably our most complicated visual effects sequence in the movie.
One of the things I really loved about the film overall was that it is a real proper kind of grown-up thriller that you don't necessarily see that often anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's really, there's some really dark moments in there. It's pretty uncompromising, and the plot is quite intricate. You have to really kind of keep up with it as it goes along.
Yes.
Were all of those elements important to you in bringing that from the book to the screen?
Yeah. I mean, I think I liked the idea of doing a real thriller, mm-hmm. an R-rated thriller. That's how the book read to me. That's what I pitched to the studio. Luckily, the studio was very positive about that, and they were great partners. They said yes to my approach and to the R rating from the beginning, and they never wavered. Luckily, it's a studio that's had some great success with R-rated films. Mm-hmm. Recently. So they really embraced it. But it was important. I think I really like the idea of having to activate an audience and making sure that an audience leans in. This is definitely not a movie that you can sort of lay back and just kind of let it wash over you, right? In terms of bombastic sound and explosions and things, you have to really pay attention. And then I think if you do, I think the payoff is quite great. But that was always a fun thing for me.
You alluded earlier on that earlier in Jen's career, she said that there were certain things that she wouldn't do on camera. And Dominica goes to some really intense places in this film. Was it your previous work with Jennifer that gave you that trust and that bond to go to some of those dark places?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think for her to say yes to doing this movie, one is she has to be ready to, you know, to partake in the kind of content that's in this movie. I mean, that's a decision only she can make. I will say that I think part of the decision making, I'm not sure she would have done it with a stranger. Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason that she said yes was that she knew that I would be very respectful, that I would listen and collaborate with her. And she trusted my taste. I know that. But beyond that, she herself just had to be ready.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Dominica in her training is taught to use absolutely everything to get on side with people, including and especially using her sexuality. How did you work to ensure that the film empowers her character?
Well, that's something that she and I spoke a lot about. I had told her up front that I was clearly not making an erotic thriller. This was not a movie that is meant to titillate in any way. So there was not going to be anything gratuitous, specifically with nudity and sexuality. And so once she signed on, we started talking a lot about it. One was so that we're both comfortable. There was no sort of tiptoeing around one mm-hmm. another. We needed to be as open as possible, but also to be as vigilant as possible about those scenes, to make sure that they married with the narrative and the themes and the tone specifically. and more empowering. And that was just something that she and the writer and I talked about a lot to try and get that right.
I wanted to talk to you about some of the torture scenes as well. I won't say exactly what it is because I think it goes into spoiler territory, but there is a scene towards the end that I've not been able to get out of my mind since seeing the film.
Is it the skin grafting?
Yeah, it's a very inventive. I've never seen that particular medical instrument being used as an instrument of torture before. It was pretty stomach churning. What was it like shooting those scenes? And
I mean, I have to say it's sort of the opposite. I get a kick out of the fact that people are so squeamish about that scene when shooting a scene like that is actually pretty ridiculous because, mm-hmm. Well, look, I'll start by saying I got the idea from watching a documentary years ago about a burn victim. It was a special effects guy in a movie set who was like handling some kind of gunpowder and went off and it burned his arms and some of his neck. Mm-hmm. And watching the process of what they do to deal with burns, including skin grafting, and I saw that tool. So I was stuck in the back of my head, and then I brought it out because, you know, there are elements when you get into a spy film, there's torture scenes and mm-hmm. And if you're going to do it, you got to do it in a new way. And I thought about this skin grafting tool, so had the writer stick it in there, including some of the description of the tool. But on set, all it is a rubber, you know, replica mm-hmm. of a skin grafting tool. And, you know, the character, I won't spoil who the character mm-hmm. is that's getting his skin grafted, you know, writhing around and tensing mm-hmm. his body and screaming and things. And I mean, you know, he really sold the pain, which is good. But, you know, in the moment, on the day, it feels like you're a 7-year-old, you know, shooting a movie with your Super 8 camera and your friends are just, you know, playing around with bad props. But
what did you use as the little kind of horrible flakes of skin?
Oh, yeah, our makeup team mm-hmm. created these like skin flaps that we could sort of peel out of the skin grafting tool. Yeah.
Yeah, I still feel queasy about that now. So in terms of Red Sparrow, you did three kind of franchise films effectively with Hunger Games. Is Red Sparrow, do you see that as something that could be a new franchise, or have you approached it as a kind of one-off project?
No, we definitely did not approach it as a one-off. I mean, I think we all love the character, we all love the world. There's definitely more stories you could tell with Dominica. But unlike the Hunger Games, where when I signed on, the dates for the next three were already laid out, right? That was a done deal. Those things are getting made. We're waiting to see whether or not people go to see the movie. You know, it's one of those tricky movies that's in that tricky zone now of, you know, fingers crossed, mm-hmm. people come out and see it and fall in love with the character in this kind of world. And ideally we get to make another one.
And would you want to be involved if there was a sequel?
Oh, 100%.
Because one thing that I'm really intrigued by that you've been attached to for a little while is this proposed kind of new film of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the status of that, and what's the sort of take on the material? And
well, I don't want to give away too much of the take. I'll stay a little tight-lipped about the take. I think mm-hmm. it's really interesting, but it's something I'm developing now and have been for a little while. And I've been working with Lisa Joy, who's a writer, but also one of the co-creators of Westworld. Mm-hmm. And she's done a great job. She's obviously, it's taken a while because she's very busy. She's, you know, shot 2 seasons of Westworld while working on this. I went off and shot Red Sparrow while working on this. So it hasn't been the fastest process, mostly because we're very busy, but she's done a great job. She's a very smart woman.
I'll be really excited to see if it does come about. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast, Francis.
Thank you.
Lawrence.
Okay, it's time now for this week's films. And we're starting with obviously Red Sparrow, a film that seems wildly appropriate for the freezing mm-hmm. cold weather. If we're experiencing the Beast from the East now, then Jennifer Lawrence is the matching beauty. See what I did there? As she plays a ballerina who has to give up her chosen profession and instead find herself recruited to become a sex spy, right? Essentially?
Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah, this is, as you've heard, Jennifer Lawrence re-teaming with Francis Lawrence, who I think we probably agree made the best Hunger Games film in Catching Fire.
Yeah, absolutely.
I went into this kind of looking forward to it. I think Jennifer Lawrence is kind of a good talent, and the trailer was interesting, especially there was a lot of chat initially that, oh, it looks like a sort of Black Widow movie. It really isn't that. It's quite a talky, kind of slow-paced at points, kind of proper Cold War political thriller. Having said that, I thought it felt a lot shorter than its kind of 2 hours, 20 minutes runtime. It's a long runtime, but I found the story actually really involving.
So Jennifer Lawrence, I think, is really good in it. I think she gives a really kind of compelling performance as Dominica, the ballerina. There's a gorgeous opening sequence at the ballet, which I thought was beautifully well shot and kind of really stirring and dramatic. And also Joel Edgerton playing opposite her. I don't think I've seen Joel Edgerton be bad in anything, even Attack of the Clones. So it's a great cast. The sexual politics of this film are extraordinarily tricky, and about half an hour into it, I had to just stop working out how I felt about some of the things that were playing out on the screen, because I needed to spend my time kind of concentrating on seeing the plot play out, because
it is a complicated
plot.
It's
a complicated
plot.
Yeah. It is. It doesn't kind of condescend to the audience at all. You're expected to keep up as it goes on. There are lots of twists, shifting allegiances. For me, it was something where I had to basically just keep watching and not try and keep tabs on who was siding with who, and just hope that by the end it all worked out. And it really did, and thought the payoff was great.
Yeah, I had some issues with it. The sexual politics is a huge issue, actually, and it's a strange film. But I think actually the politics are, if anything, more startling to me, because it feels to me this is a film set in the modern day. This is a film set in, if we're experiencing a second Cold War, then it's set in the second Cold War, not the traditional one. But it still feels exactly like an old Cold War movie.
Yeah, in fact, I think I spent the first maybe 45 minutes or so wondering, I don't know exactly when this is set. And then it's only when you see someone, I think, using a smartphone that I was like, oh, okay, so it is modern day.
That's it. And I think it so leans into the tropes of the old, you know, Red Menace kind of stuff. And I think there's an element just in the whole premise of these sort of almost superhuman, almost inhuman sex spies. Like, there is something inhuman about using something so intimate in such a cold-blooded political manner that it harks back for me to the real sort of Red Scare, Reds under the bed, Reds in the bed kind of propaganda stories that you would have heard back in the day. And this real assumption that Russian people, and the Russian government certainly, are somehow less individual, less human, less feeling than their Western counterparts, which I find really uncomfortable at times, because it felt like it was almost superhuman powers. It was almost like sort of a Black Widow kind of theory, but without any sort of, you know, hyper-realistic framework around that. It really seemed to be giving them some kind of... It really seemed paranoid of modern Russia in a way that is... That surprised me, and not necessarily in a good way. So it's a very strange tone, and I think there's so much plot in this that it maybe almost should have been like an 8-hour, you know,
or like a series.
It's. I mean, there's some dense stuff in there, and I feel like if you had that much time, then maybe you'd have time to develop it in different directions and do some different things with it.
I have to say, I think it does a lot well in that runtime. Yeah. It's a lot more extreme than I expected. There is some really intense kind of violence, some really strong nudity, some really kind of disturbing scenes in there. And also, oh my goodness, there is a torture scene that I spoke to Francis Lawrence about. And I didn't mention it explicitly in the interview, but he did, so I feel like it's okay to say. But there is a use of a skin graft machine as a torture device, which is, I was turning my head away from the screen. It was really intensely gross stuff. So it really isn't the Black Widow movie that you might be expecting. But when I kind of tried to stop worrying about how I felt about it, I did find myself pretty involved in it. And I think it is one of those quite rare, unapologetically grown-up thrillers that really pushes the boundaries of kind of what you see in mainstream films, that stood out as possibly one of the only like real intense kind of adult-oriented thrillers since something like Fincher's Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, on that kind of scale and that kind of mainstream level.
Yeah, and I mean, by the way, we should mention a hell of a supporting cast. Even beside Joel Edgerton, you've got Matthias Schoenaerts, Charlotte Rampling, Mary Louise Parker, Kieran Hines, Joely Richardson, Bill Camp. I mean, it is Jeremy Irons in there as well. It is a deep, deep bench of great people. Sergei Polunin as well.
I feel I should say something, but I haven't seen it, so... I'd really like to see this. It looks good. Mm-hmm. Also, Mary Louise Parker was in The West Wing.
Thanks, James.
This is what I... In fact, I might go and see it tonight because it's showing.
Well, there you have it, people.
So, yeah, I'm going to go and see it tonight. It got 3 stars. There you go. I can share that with you. It got our illustrious editor, Terry White, has given this film 3 of our best stars, and that is a recommendation.
That is a recommendation. I would very much agree with that star rating, and not just because she is the all-powerful editor. So, next up, we have, let's go with Game Night, which is a tale of a suburban board gaming evening gone horribly wrong. If only Dan Jolin were here to explain how the simple roll of a D20 could have, you know, just solved the whole thing, probably.
I'm going to nod and pretend that I know what that means.
Yeah, so this is a sort of suburban group led by Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams. They are a happily married couple, and they're both extraordinarily competitive people. Their names are Annie and Max, but they love nothing more than winning, basically. But despite this, they somehow have friends who are willing to come and play with them. So their friends are played by Lamorne Morris, who plays Kevin. I've got Kylie Bunbury as Michelle and Billy Magnussen as Ryan. He brings along, you know, he's notorious in this group for always bringing along a very beautiful but very dim date. So he always comes last in every game they play. So this week, he's not going to do that. So he brings along Sharon Horgan, who's proper, to kind of help him out. But the fly in the ointment is Kyle Chandler. Now, he plays Max's more successful brother, Brooks. And he, when he's hosting games night at his house for once, he suggests, right, let's step this all up a gear. We're going to have one of those kind of live interactive games. So somebody's going to be kidnapped and all the rest of you have to follow the clues.
Kind of like David Fincher's The Game.
Exactly like David Fincher's The Game, except played for laughs.
Okay.
Yes. So exactly like that, genuinely. This is the game, you know.
The game night.
The game night, exactly. And things get incredibly complicated from there, and I'm not going to tell you anything else about it. I think it makes sense. I'm not 100% sure. I assume if we talk to the screenwriter, who's Mark Perez, he would be able to explain to me that it all makes sense. I'm just going to trust him on that.
So it's quite a plotty film.
It is extremely twisty and turny, and there are some things you will not make that, like, see coming and possibly don't actually make sense, but I'm just going to assume that they do. We should mention Jesse Plemons is in it as Gary, who's Annie and Max's neighbour, and he used to be part of the game night with his wife, but having been dumped by her and divorced by her, he's now been kind of left out in the cold because he's incredibly creepy. Like, he's like, imagine the creepiest man ever.
James.
And then make him much creepier, and you've got Jesse Plemons in this film.
He does not know the burn that has just been placed.
I don't know what you're saying.
We were just being nice about you, James.
I was checking my emails because I just didn't feel I can contribute, but I will say I nearly went to see this film then didn't.
Thanks, James.
There was a screening of it, and I was going to go, but it didn't go. But they sent me a board game.
Yeah,
which
we've
was
got
themed.
A game night board game.
Yeah, we have a game
maybe
night
we
game.
We should host our own game night and play the game night board game.
Well, based on this film, that could lead to disaster. But I will say this is very funny. It's well paced. I mean, I don't remember a single line from it now. I had trouble remembering character names. So it's not exactly going to, you know, necessarily change your life. But at the same time, as a good studio comedy, I think it's been a while since we really had one that worked. This kind of glossy, well-made, well-cast studio comedy has kind of been having a bit of in the doldrums a little bit recently. So it's kind of good to see it working this well again. So fair play. We gave this
4 stars.
4 stars, which is a definite recommendation.
Yeah. How is Jason Bateman in it? Because he is so great in Arrested Development and then is in so many pretty bad kind of comedy films.
Yeah, he kind of is, but I think he's good here, and I think he and Rachel McAdams work really well together. She has not been this funny in a long time, and gets so much more to do than she has done in any film I've seen her in recently. Doctor Strange!
Oh, God.
and it's good to see her given a chance to actually show what she can do.
Does she play Operation in this?
She should do. She'd be better at it than he was. Anyway, but yeah, genuinely, she's been massively underused of late, and it's really good to see that. So, 4 stars for Game Night. So, one more film to go. This is the Oscar-nominated A Fantastic Woman from Chilean director Sebastián Lelio. And it stars Daniela Vega as a woman who has been kind of abandoned, basically, after her older boyfriend, who's played by Francisco Reyes, he dies suddenly. And she finds herself, first of all, under suspicion for his death, also rejected by his family and cut out of his life because she is a trans woman. So that's basically the setup. And this is, it's a It's a really good film, mm-hmm. and it is a phenomenal performance from Vega. I think she's such a talent in this, and she's really, really... The camera barely leaves her face. Like, mm-hmm. she is almost always in the centre of the screen, and she absolutely holds your attention the whole way through, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal performance. But it is a really kind of nuanced and sensitive and sort of confident take on... You know, what I fear must be an all too common mm-hmm. occurrence, which is just this woman who's suddenly facing a very hostile world entirely mm-hmm. on her own. I mean, the death of any loved one is going to be difficult, but the death of essentially your only, I don't want to say your only protection, but it feels almost like that. It feels like something is stripped away from her life that leaves her vulnerable to just the whole world. And so you see, you know, just microaggressions against mm-hmm. her and her identity, but also like full-on aggression and violence towards her in the wake of this death and while she's trying to deal with her own grief. But what sort of gives this film its, I guess, uplift or mm-hmm. its sense of optimism are these sort of fantastical moments where the real world kind of falls away a little bit and she's able to kind of escape into the world that she envisages, that she hopes for, that she sees inside her head. And so you have like a fabulous dance number at one point and just some gorgeous, gorgeous imagery that just kind of gives you hope that she's going to be okay, basically, no matter what kind of comes against her. So it's a really lovely film. I don't know if it's going to win Best Picture or Best Foreign Film mm-hmm. On Sunday night at the Oscars, but I definitely think it's in with a chance. I think it's a really good film. And she is going to make history either way because she is the first openly trans woman to present at the Oscars.
Fantastic.
But honestly, it's just a wonderful performance and a really, really beautiful, beautiful film. So even if you wouldn't normally go and see this sort of thing, mm-hmm. I think it's worth a go. And we gave that 4 stars.
We haven't mentioned the Oscars, which are, of course, happening very shortly.
Yes, Sunday night. So what are your predictions?
I predict they will give out the Oscars to mainly the right people this year.
Okay. Who do you consider the right people? What do you think is going to win Best Picture?
I think if Fish Fucker gets any, I'm going to be upset.
I'm going to be very happy.
And Ben's going to get fired. And I want them all to go to the billboards.
And I'm especially going to be fired because I do not like 3 billboards.
Oh, what is wrong with you?
I am
going to get 3 billboards outside Camden, London, basically saying that 3 billboards should win.
Well, I'm sure that will sway the voters who already sent in their ballots, James.
No, this is going to be fun. We're doing it all at Chris's house.
Yes.
So that should be a giggle.
I genuinely would love Get Out to win Best Picture as a film that was released way out of the kind of typical Oscar Best Picture season that has massively steered the conversation in film over the last 12 months. I think it's almost a year since I saw
almost,
it. And it is, it holds up so well on repeat viewings. It's so rare that a genre film gets that recognition, which is another, mm-hmm. as well as me loving it, another thing that I'd really like for The Shape of Water, that even though it is quite prestige-y, that is effectively like a
it's a monster
film.
Movie.
It's a monster movie.
You know, it would be interesting to see a genuinely bad film win the Oscar. I think
my goodness.
Yeah, it would. I'm intrigued to see if 3 billboards does
well. I hate to be the voice of reason here, somewhere in the middle. I am with James in thinking that 3 billboards will win.
Yes.
I am with Ben in hoping that Get Out actually wins. And I do think it's in with a chance.
I would be happy with that. Get Out was fantastic. I think it has almost no chance of winning, but...
I don't. I think it's actually in with a very good chance. I think that Shape of Water is good apart from the love story, which I thought didn't land. So I'm walking the line between you two. So.
I do wonder with Get Out, because obviously all the Academy voters get their screeners and watch through them all, that it might play in Get Out's favour, that it is just such a straightforwardly enjoyable film. Yeah. There is so much nuance in it and there is so much kind of culturally around it that makes it exceptional, but the bare basics of the film, it is a really entertaining like hour and 40 minutes, and I wonder if that will play in its favour.
And look, The Silence of the Lambs won the Big Five, so it's not beyond the realm of possibility that a film released in the spring can do the business. Now, admittedly, that was 27 years ago, but that let's not rule it out completely. I think it could happen. Are we all saying McDormand for actress?
I think so, yes.
Are we all saying Oldman for actor?
I don't know. I think Frances McDormand will get it, and she is amazing in that film. She is the thing that I love in that film, but was so swept away by Sally Hawkins in The Shape of Water.
You do realise the only reason The Shape of Water is even nominated is because they sent Michael Shannon round to all the voters' houses and had him shout at them.
Dragged people around.
That would be amazing. Oh my God.
But the her performance in that is so charming, and it still blows my mind that she manages to convey someone who has no literal voice shouting. That scene kind of blows my mind.
She is phenomenal in that. I have to say, if it wasn't going to Frances McDormand, I would give it to Saoirse Ronan,
who I
think is just phenomenal in Lady Bird. And I just worry that it's the kind of role that people don't appreciate how good it is.
Now, do you think that Greta Gerwig has... I mean, what would you put her odds at?
I think they are low. I agree. I think that film is brilliantly directed, actually. But I think it's brilliantly directed in a way that people won't necessarily award.
Yes, that's what I feel as well. I'd love to see that win Best Director. Yeah. Not just for... I just think as a directorial debut, it's an incredible film.
But, I mean, same with Get Out. So, I mean, debutant directors in that category, which is phenomenal.
I mean, very tricky. There's only one film I know shouldn't get it.
I think this year's Best Director category is one of the best in years. Yeah. That you've got Gerwig, you've got Peele, you've got Nolan for the first time.
Yeah.
Del Toro. Who's the fifth?
Oh, is it Paul Thomas Anderson?
That is like an outstanding kind of selection of people, and I think there are so many interesting voices in there. It's we already know my feelings about Shape of Water. Gerwig would be an amazing win. Peele would be an amazing win. Like Paul Thomas Anderson would be great as well. Like Phantom Thread is so good, and it's not just a film about sewing, as I can see James looking at me right now. but I mean, to be honest, I would be happy with any of them winning. But
yeah, that's a really strong category. Speaking of strong categories. Are there any Hoyt van Hoytma-ites in the house, or are we all agreed that if Roger Deakins doesn't get it, we're rioting?
Deakins for the win.
I'm always rooting for the Deke.
Yeah, it has to be the Deke. Mm-hmm. This is Oscar nomination number 14. It is time
just
and past time. Just
already.
Give him the statue.
And it would be like massively well deserved as well, because like Blade Runner 2049 just looks so flipping beautiful.
It's a gorgeous film. It's going to be an interesting competition actually below the line between I think Blade Runner, Dunkirk for a few categories and
some of the
Shape
technical
of Water.
Stuff.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting times ahead. Anyway, the Oscars are obviously on this Sunday night.
Yes.
You can watch them on Sky, which I believe has a dedicated Oscar channel on its cinema. What's it? And you can get it through Nine TV.
It does indeed.
I don't know.
We will be live blogging it on the website and tweeting along as we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From Chris's house. Live from Chris's house. And if you look out of his window and... No, you really can't see it at all.
You can't. No, you cannot see the Kodak Theatre from Chris's house.
No.
That
no,
is
you can't.
True.
But yeah, if you want to follow along with us in the very early hours of the morning as we get slowly more and more delirious...
Yes, please do. Yes. Please send snacks to Chris's house.
And Lucozade and coffee.
Yes.
Any caffeinated beverages.
Well, Godspeed, my friends, Godspeed. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by David Oyelowo and Lynn Ramsey, assuming that I pressed record on the interview I did earlier. Until then, it's goodbye from James.
Hi.
Goodbye from Ben.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to start the 3-hour process of putting on enough coats to survive the journey home. Goodbye.